Hello everyone, welcome to the second season of the series of podcasts with IEEE Electron Devices Society Luminaries. As the world's largest professional organization, IEEE plays significant role to enhance the quality of our life. Electron Devices Society, or EDS, encompasses activities involving electron devices, the main enabler for today's digital world. I'm Muhammad Mustafa Hussain, a professor of Elmore Family School of Electrical and Computer Engineering of Purdue University. I play a variety of roles in different capacities within the Electron Devices Society of IEEE. In this series of podcasts, we will be interviewing those EDS members who have made remarkable impacts in our society through their innovations and dedication. Our guest is someone who has made one of the most exemplary transitions from academia to industry, Dr. Richard Swanson, former professor of Stanford University and then founder of SunPower. Richard Swanson was born in Davenport, Iowa in 1945. He received his bachelor's in electrical engineering and master's in electrical engineering from Ohio State University in 1969 and then began dissertation research as a National Science Foundation Fellow at Stanford University. His research into the modeling and fabrication of CMOS integrated circuits for micropower applications resulted in the theory and first published experimental data on threshold adjustment by ion implantation, which is now a common industrial practice that enables low voltage battery powered electronics. He also developed the first theory on the operation of MOS transistors in the weak inversion regime. His paper, Ion Implanted Complementary Transistors in Low Voltage Circuits, jointly authored with Professor Jim Mindel, was awarded classic paper status by the Journal of Solid State Circuits in 2003 as one of the 10 most cited papers since the inception of the journal in 1966. After receiving the PhD in 1974, he received an IBM postdoctoral fellowship at Stanford University to study techniques for solar electric power generation. In 1976, he joined the faculty at Stanford as assistant professor of electrical engineering and obtained funding from the Electric Power Research Institute to investigate thermophotovoltaic energy conversion for solar applications. Since then, he has been actively involved in photovoltaic research and industrialization. He was promoted to associate professor in 1982. At Stanford, Dr. Swanson supervised 13 doctoral students, many of whom are active in the photovoltaics industry. His areas of research have generally involved investigation into the semiconductor properties of silicon relevant for better understanding the operation of silicon solar cells. This has included studies of heavy doping effects, surface recombination, minority carrier transport, gettering, defect recombination kinetics, audio recombination, and light trapping. These studies have helped pave the way for steady improvement in silicon solar cell performance. Professor Swanson and his group conceived and developed the point contact solar cell. Laboratory version of these cells achieved 28% conversion efficiency in concentrator cells and 23% efficiency in large area one sun cells. In 1991, Dr. Swanson resigned from his faculty position to devote full time to SunPower Corporation a company he founded to develop and commercialize cost-effective photovoltaic power systems. In its early days, SunPower solar cells powered Honda to victory in the 1993 World Solar Challenge and powered NASA's high-altitude solar-powered airplane Helios to 96,500 feet, a record altitude for any non-rocket aircraft. SunPower received the NASA Public Service Award for its contribution to the Helios program. These record-setting cells received the IR100 Award in 1995. In 2005, SunPower became publicly listed on the NASDAQ stock exchange under the symbol SPWR. With the acquisition of PowerLight in 2007, SunPower has become a global leader in photovoltaic systems, leading in residential rooftops, commercial installations, and large ground-mounted power plants. Today, SunPower manufactures over 1,000 megawatts per year of the highest performing solar cells commercially available. Dr. Swanson retired from SunPower in 2012. Dr. Swanson has received widespread recognition for his work. In 2002, he was awarded the William R. Cherry Award by the IEEE for outstanding contributions to the photovoltaic field. In 2006, the Becquerel Prize in Photovoltaics from the European Communities. He was elected a fellow of the IEEE in 2008 and a member of the National Academy of Engineering of the United States of America in 2009. He received the 2009 Economist Magazine Energy Innovator Award. In 2010, he was awarded the IEEE Jin-Ichi Nishizawa Medal for the conception and commercialization of high-efficiency point-contact solar cell technology. And in 2011, the Carl Bauer Solar Energy Medal of Merit Award. He has served on numerous advisory boards, including Stanford University School of Engineering Advisory Council, UC Davis Physics Department Advisory Board, Foothill College Science Learning Center Advisory Council, a director of Activate at LBNL, a director of the World Watch Institute, the Institute of Photovoltaics, France. Dr. Swanson currently serves as president of BBNY LLC, a company devoted to developing low carbon emission residences, and is director of Known Energy, a company developing low cost, long term storage. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Okay.
It's beautiful, actually. Spring has finally arrived here. So.
Right. I will start from the very beginning. So if you can kindly share with us about your childhood, your school life, the early life.
Early days. I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, in a nice neighborhood, was pretty much, I think, what you would call a nerd as a young child. My hobbies were model airplanes and ham radio. I became a ham radio operator when I was 14, for example, so that's kind of what I did. Had a rather normal childhood, I would say. For my father was a professor at Ohio State University, as I got older, I kind of rebelled against being a nerd. I discovered that it wasn't a popular thing to be, and so I decided to go to a liberal arts college, a small liberal arts college in Ohio called Worcester. College of Worcester, and after several months there, discovered that I really was a nerd. There was no escaping it, so I dropped out and transferred back to Ohio State in engineering. That's where I got my undergraduate degree. But it was a great experience. I had some very transformative experiences. I don't know how much time you want to take on this kind of thing, but one of them was there was an oil discovery in Ohio at the time in a town called Mount Gilead. And that's where I found people were going to get work on the oil field. The town of Mount Gilead had been overrun by people from Oklahoma wearing cowboy hats and cowboy boots, and and they were drilling everywhere. Lots of people actually destroyed their houses in Mount Gilead to install pumping and drilling rigs on their property, which I didn't understand at the time. As I got into the energy field, you know, I later learned how the the laws around extracting oil and stuff work, but at the time it seemed kind of strange. And and then when I got there, it was raining, and they said, well, we can't hire anybody right now because it's raining. Come back when we can start drilling again. And I found another job. And then when it stopped raining, they started drilling, and they discovered it was a mistake. And they said, oh, our bad. And they packed up all their drilling equipment and went back to Oklahoma, leaving this poor town just wondering what they had done. You know, it was interesting for me to see how people just went nuts with the prospect that they could become wealthy. And when that was no longer the case, the poor town suffered mightily. And in fact, I later found out that because of that experience, the whole oil industry has changed the way they approach new finds and that sort of thing. But it instilled in me a real impression of how you can kind of go, with greed can sort of rule you and take you down paths that are not necessarily a good path. That stuck with me through the rest of my life, basically, that experience.
Right. Thank you so much for sharing, very inspiring, because, when you mentioned that you were a nerd and your hobby was to play with the aeroplane, and you are from Ohio. Ohio is the birthplace of aeroplane.
Yes.
Because of the Wright brothers, right? So there is kind of, you can't escape that. But I think more importantly, as you mentioned, about a small town being ransacked because of the human greed, rather than thinking a little bit deeply before going into action, which actually continues even today in today's world. And at some point, I will come back to this, because I guess this somehow, at least in your subconscious mind, left an impression which eventually led you to establish the one of the iconic companies in USA, which has global impact on solar cells. So we'll come back to this part.
Okay.
And so I do know that you went to Stanford for your graduate study. So if you can share a little bit from that portion of your life, your research experience, the graduate life, like those.
Sure. Well, that was another transformative experience, probably even more so than the Mount Gilead one. I had gotten excited about the solid state revolution coming, transistors and stuff. And in fact, we had in our classrooms at Ohio State some of the very first transistors, commercially available ones from Fairchild. And it looked like a wondrous new world. Ohio State, ironically, had a very powerful power electronics, power engineering program, rotating machinery. In fact, one of the courses we had, required courses we had to take, was a course on rotating machinery, which I doubt many universities still do. And it's kind of ironic in that I came away thinking, well, the semiconductors are the new thing. Rotating machinery is sort of a, last century kind of deal, and I wasn't that excited about it. So what's ironic is that I eventually got into the energy industry myself. So I never would have thought that for a moment when I was excited about microelectronics and semiconductors. Stanford was one of the sort of premier places on the front lines of this semiconductor revolution, and I was sort of drawn, siren song-like, to come to Silicon Valley. It wasn't even called Silicon Valley then, but so I was just wonderfully blessed to have received an offer to do graduate work at Stanford. My advisor was Jim Mindel, who was recently honored by the IEEE also, and he turned out to be just fabulous. I mean, I to a large degree modeled my professional career after his example of how to be a great advisor and a great researcher. He had was operating in this place called the Stanford Solid State Circuits Laboratory and Integrated Circuit Laboratory. And I became a student there and was pretty much launched on a career in microelectronics, I would say. That was my specialty. And it was a wonderful experience. It was sort of everybody at that time, this is in 1969, who wanted to get into the semiconductor world would have some presence at Stanford. They would send people there to learn it. People from all over the world came. It was a very stimulating and exciting environment to be dumped into as a young student. And so it was fabulous. I mean, and it opened huge doors everywhere. It wasn't until the oil crisis in 1973 that I started thinking about maybe a career change. And we had plenty of time to think about these things because the younger people won't remember, but there were huge lines to get gasoline in 1973, sometimes taking many hours to get through. And so standing there, I started thinking about that maybe energy was, after all, even though I had kind of turned my nose up at it, Ohio State, if you will, was after all important and an emerging sort of thing. And eventually, after some thought, decided to do a career shift as I was graduating and get into photovoltaics.
I think, as you mentioned, although it happened in 1973, a few years before I was even born, but I've seen those videos of like long line, long queue in the gas stations. And as of today, as you can see what's happening around the world, this the energy crisis or energy demand are dictating many unwanted and absolutely abhorrent things all over the world. As we can see that even with the current, the world affairs, that we know that in a sense that capitalizing energy sources as a measure of taking people as hostage in a sense.
Right,
That's
right.
and from that perspective, not only the its impact on the environment. That was the I believe at a personal level was the right move for you. I have a question, and I think I will it's not from the scripted one. I'm going to take a departure from there. Today, as a faculty, I was in the industry, then I became a faculty, and we do have this urgency in a sense that how we can translate our lab innovations. And we can transfer them as a technology, which actually goes to millions of people, billions, if not even, why not hundreds, right? And you are one of those few people who had a solid, accomplished academic career, but you took your research and then you established one of the most iconic companies in the US, right, on the solar sun power. So how was your transition? And in a sense that whatever you are going to share, that's going to be in a going to benefit our audience, because many actually would like to know, because not everyone has born with that capability, and there is no harm in that. But the question is that if, like, you know, your thought process, your experience will definitely benefit many to understand how far they can go, what they might want to do, and where they might need to stop.
Wow. Okay. Well, I think, first off, let me say that being an engineer is a blessed occupation, in my view. I think, you know, engineers are sort of like artists in that they create things that didn't exist before. And that's to distinguish it a little bit from a scientist who is more or less exploring the world and finding things that always existed, if you will. And so this aspect of engineering that makes it so fulfilling and so rewarding, of creating new things for the world, is, I think, something to be nurtured and encouraged. And it also makes for a bit of a tension in an academic environment, in my view. A pure physicist, for example, exists in a university department and he's happy there and can flourish there, and that's, you know, where he best fits in. An engineer, to some degree, in an academic environment, is always torn a little bit between the practical and the teaching. And so this is something that deserves, in my view, a lot of thought, how to balance the academic aspect of engineering, which versus the practical aspect of actually creating something. And at Stanford, I think they had done a very good job of that. It was a good tutorial, if you will, in the microelectronics laboratory. They had an affiliates program. We had with industry. And the very first talks that we gave as young students, PhD students, were generally to the affiliates when they would meet, because you couldn't mess up too much, you know, with them. And the thing is that the affiliates, you know, these were companies like Intel and Fairchild and other companies in microelectronics. They seemed to appreciate what Stanford was doing. They came there to see what was coming in the research labs, and we appreciated them because we knew that microelectronics was nothing if it wasn't commercialized. You know, if it remained a purely academic thing. So in my sort of view, perhaps rose-colored glasses view of that period, I think there was a wonderful give and take between the university and the industry. And to the degree that that can be recreated and captured with new challenges, I think it's good, you know. And but it's hard. It's hard to do, and I don't have any, you know, hard and fast prescription on how to make it as successful as the Stanford program was, but I see that as an aspirational goal to have a great connection with industry and get those viewpoints, bringing those viewpoints back and forth, and that was particularly eye-opening for me, even when I was still in microelectronics. You know, for example, in making a microcircuit, yield was very important, and yield was depended on a lot of things, but among other things, particles getting on the wafer and contaminants and that sort of thing. And so we did a lot of looking at that in the lab, and I remember interacting with industry and thinking, you know, this, we've got some pretty cool theories about oxygen clusters and yada 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 on the chip and getting this stare back. You know, I just got to get my yield up. You know, I don't have time to mess around with your fancy precipitation of oxygen in the wafer. Just help me get my yield up so we can survive. You know, and that, you know, at first I was disappointed that they weren't more impressed with it, and then it suddenly hit me: they shouldn't be. I mean, this is, you know, they do have to make the product, and that is hard. And so I think that experience was, that, I mean, that's just one tiny example, I think, of how industry and academia can interact in a positive way and learn from each other. And through that interaction, people don't worry about oxygen precipitation in silicon anymore. I mean, that that's solved. You know, that, you know, you. You get the your recipes from the tool vendors, you know, right, on how to do the make the chip, you know, but that wasn't the case 40 years ago. It was tough and fun, and everybody contributed to creating what, you know, what became the microelectronics industry. So I don't know how often you can repeat that story with new challenges and sort of thing, but it's certainly worth an effort, and I don't know what's happening today, you know, with artificial intelligence and that sort of thing. I'm sure similar kinds of interactions are going on. So I just see the academic versus industrial part of engineering as just one of the beautiful tensions in the whole thing that makes it so exciting.
Yeah, really fascinating. You reminded me of my first and only interview after I graduated. So that was in TI. So oh. I was asked, so I was meeting with CTO Hans Stark, and I think I was recruited as one of the youngest process integration lead. And at that point, I was asked that whether I was a Y person or how person. And I actually responded that depending on the time crunch and the value, I remain as a how person. But for long-term solution, I am happy to find out why so that I can have a better how.
That captures it. Yeah.
Right. So
exactly
I was
trying to say. Yeah.
Right. I was very young, and for some reason, he liked it so much. So I even before I left, the premises, it was a two days long interview session. I knew that I had the offer, but I think like the reason I wanted to share is, like, you know, as you mentioned, this is there is a some sort of elitism in the academia that we think really, you know, the out of the box or just blue horizon, but at the same time, we also have to appreciate the fact that most of our industry folks, they were also trained in academia. So we are actually not adversaries. We are really partners in this case. Right. And anything that our students do, they can actually be powerful, because whatever they learn here, they take it and they start translating those. And I think, like, you know, that your experience really summarizes all those. From here, I want to actually, like, you know, ask you this question, because I think you have already laid down your background and, like, you know, how your thought process evolved over the time. So these two questions are kind of tied up. So the one question is that definitely that we can currently, I think we understand that what, you know, what made you click toward microelectronics, or in general, the electron devices. The question is that you also mentioned that, which I absolutely concur with you that in engineering, we either have to solve a decade-long problem that many actually decided that it's not solvable or it's too hard to solve, or we really think about something and then create that thing, right? Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, do you think that you had eureka moment or... You know, I do recognize that some actually think that this is a bit controversial question, but you know that, you know, how do you find it? What is your perspective on that?
I don't know about a eureka moment, but I can say that when I decided to go into academics as a professional career, and to research photovoltaics, solar cells, the way I approached it was that we had this problem. The solar cells were understood. They had been invented. The physics was, you know, photons were, you know, established as particles. And it, unlike when Becquerel built his first solar cell, they didn't even know about photons, but we knew all the essential physics was there. How the device worked. It was, however, at the time, pick a number, but say 200 times too expensive for terrestrial power production, right? So that's an engineering challenge, right? I mean, it's not obvious that it's solvable. 200 is a big number to take the cost out, but it is in essence an engineering problem, but it's a very difficult engineering problem in the sense that it requires understanding lots of material science and semiconductor device physics and that sort of thing. So what I did was, because there were very few jobs available in the solar industry for my graduating students, I took aspects of the cell that were limiting its performance. The overall arching thing was we needed to get more power out of the cell as well as reduce the cost. And us sort of have students work on the materials science of that issue. For example, you put diffusions in to make a PN junction. At first blush, the silicon was one of the most explored materials in the world at that point. I mean, in terms of its understanding. But the minute you sort of focused in on the real issues, okay, we're going to diffuse phosphorus in. What is the minority carrier lifetime in the phosphorus? I don't know. Well, what controls the minority carrier lifetime in the phosphorus? What kind of defects in there are responsible for recombination? And recombination of electrons and holes being the main loss mechanism that solar cells have. And every time we would look more closely at it, we'd find that there were huge open areas that were where nothing was known. For example, surface passivation was very understood at that time, growing oxides on silicon. But what really caused the recombination of the electron holes was a mystery, you know. So I found that, you could just go on and on this kind of thing, but I found that they made wonderful PhD theses, and my students, for example, Jesus Dualamo at MIT was one of my students, and he had some fantastic insights into this problem. One of the aspects was that the literature. There was this effect called band gap shrinkage. And when you highly doped silicon, the band gap went down. Okay, what causes that, et cetera. And the literature was all over the map on how much band gap shrunk, what the mobility was of minority carriers in highly doped regions, what the lifetime of minority carriers was in highly doped. I mean, there were disagreements within the literature by many orders of magnitude on these things. So he had this insight that the problem was that there's really only two parameters you can measure in a highly doped region. That's the minority carrier density and the lifetime and the diffusion cost, three parameters. And people were making different assumptions about all of those and then reporting on another measurement, which would throw it way off. So on the one hand, This was fairly fundamental semiconductor physics, but it was couched in the direction of solving a particular problem. We wanted to improve the efficiency of the solar cell. What is limiting the efficiency of the solar cell? And that sort of thing. So that, I think that worked out pretty well. As a way to do engineering in a academic environment. I don't mean doing materials science. I don't mean semiconductor physics. I mean engineering, but using the tools of science to a maximal degree to kind of solve the problem. And that's one of the things about engineering that's different than science, I think. To an engineer, once you realize what your job is, science is a tool. And it's just one of the tools on your palette. And if you can use it to solve the problem, great. But you don't have to. If you could luck onto the solution, engineering solution, and that's just as good. But the science is really a tool, and I think it's fun. It's you really do when you step back, almost envision yourself like an artist. You dip your paintbrush. Oh, let me look into semiconductor multi particle physics and see what it says about here, and paint that on your palette a little bit and see what that does, and that kind of thing. And so I think that, I'm not saying that that's the only avenue to really do good academic work in an engineering discipline, but it's kind of the way I approached it, and I was pretty happy with the results.
No, obviously, as you said, engineering is equivalent to science as long as we use the word applied in front of science. Right, right.
It's not that you can't accidentally do science, I mean, I think, one of my heroes, Richard Feynman, famously said that there were two engineers that contributed to science. One was Sadi Carnot, and the other was Claude Shannon. Okay, so it's possible to sort of accidentally create.
Right,
You
right,
shouldn't
right.
rule it out, if you will.
Yeah. Okay. As our conversation is progressing, I'm going to now switch to a little bit lighter portion of our conversation, which is very popular with our audience. We call it the rapid fire round, where we will be asking you some questions, which will allow the audience to know you more intimately at a personal level. And you may choose, to respond in a word or two, that's preferred, but no pressure. You can also elaborate,
I
okay?
hate this,
Whenever
but
you're ready.
I'll try it.
Okay. What are your hobbies?
Well, my main hobby today is racing sailboats.
Okay.
I gave up ham radio long ago, by the way.
Okay. Very good. Music or movie, which one you enjoy more?
Say that again. How?
Music or movie, which one you enjoy more?
I enjoy music more, but sort of as a background, elevator kind of music while I'm working on something.
Okay. Okay. What is the book you are reading now?
I just finished reading Yuval Harari's *Sapiens*, which I found very insightful and interesting. And right now, however, I am not immersed in a book because I have a new project that I'm sucked into.
Okay, very good. What is your favorite cuisine?
I think Italian food for sure. They pretty much
Okay.
nailed it. The Italians did on food.
Okay. I think the next question is kind of redundant because you already mentioned that your hobby currently is sailing. So any sports you enjoy rather besides that?
Besides sailing, Well, that's evolved over the years. In college, I was a wrestler, but realized that I was never going to make any money as a wrestler, and engineering had more promise. So I gravitated towards that towards the end. I love going to football games, just the energy of the crowd and everything. And I can understand football. It's because it goes in sort of set pieces rather than basketball, which is very confusing and fluid, and soccer the same for me.
Okay. What is your favorite travel spot?
My favorite what?
Travel spot.
Travel spot? Okay. I think the south of France is my favorite place.
Okay. Yeah, many people actually go there, Riviera. Okay. So I will now actually come to the last portion of our conversation. Here we will look into the future through your eyes, your perspective. Okay. So from that session, my first question is, what is your thought about electronics in the future?
Well, I think, making predictions is hard about the future, especially, as the Yogi Berra said. But I think it's confused because ever since I moved out of microelectronics into photovoltaics, there has been talk of the end of Moore's Law. And because engineers are engineers, they manage to sort of keep scaling going, in a way. And in fact, I have to admit that one of the things that drove me to solar from microelectronics is I was getting the feeling that microelectronics become mature and stagnant. And this was in 1973, before the term VLSI even existed, I think. So about that, I was totally wrong. And the field has continued to progress immensely, and as we all know, and it's affecting every aspect of our daily life. So I don't know where it's all headed. We're all immersed in it, and what I do know is some advice that I got from a friend, which is good advice, historically anyway, which is whatever you do, you should do it in a manner that you benefit from Moore's Law, not that you hope Moore's Law is dead. So I think electronics, whether it's in quantum computing or all of the fancy new things, has just got a huge future, and of course causes a lot of head scratching, and what's going to happen with artificial intelligence and that sort of thing. And I listen to all of the pundits talking about that. I don't know how to make an opinion about it. I really, really don't. Just hope for the best. I mean, the only thing that gives me hope is that I think overall the progress of technology over the last centuries has been a net plus for mankind. There's ups and downs, but the trend line is a plus in my view. That life today is better than it was as a serf in 400 years ago. I think so. However, so I feel, I hope that that will continue, and that people will have the maturity and presence and to figure out how to deal with the technologies that come along, and make that things this trend will continue, where life 100 years from now will be better in many ways than it is today. And a big, I'm sure a big aspect of that will be the contributions of electronics to it. You know, I don't, I wish I had something concrete to say, you know, especially since I'm not in the field anymore, just sort of, you know, trying to figure out how to use Zoom calls best. I would certainly think if I were a young engineer today that the whole field is just ripe with exciting opportunities.
That's right. That's right. I think that Moore's law is sort of like a philosophy, in a sense that when Gordon Moore said that if we can double the number of transistors in a given area in every 2 years, then it will be beneficial. I think that it is not about the scaling. It is about that having a quantifiable goal and to work for that goal, because the overarching objective has been to, in a sense, to make our life experience better. That's the objective of what we do. Electronics are, in a sense, in a one way, to express that, it to facilitate that objective. And from that perspective, I do not think that the Moore's law will be dead or needs to be dead or anything like that. Right. Right. Okay. The next question is there anything that strikes your mind which can be better today? It can be any technological, it can be non-technological, it doesn't matter.
Anything that could be better today, you're saying?
Yeah.
Well, I think the problem area that that I've been most involved in recently has been reducing carbon footprint from our activities, and you certainly, from my perspective anyway, have to admit we could do a lot better in reducing carbon emissions. And how I think, you know, it's an interesting question, because we certainly have the technologies and to do it, and they're coming along. And so the thing that we need is some kind of vision, I think, is, you know, how to get there. And I don't think that the either the proponents of reducing of global warming, reducing the impact of global warming through carbon dioxide emission reductions, or the adversaries are doing a very good job of addressing the problem in a responsible, realistic way, in a sane way. And I mean, let me show point out, for example, that the we all know the climate can change dramatically, and during the last million years or so, we've oscillated between a glacial period and what's called an interglacial period, which is warmer. And we've had unusual stability in temperature during the last 15 or 20,000 years, which has really facilitated the emergence of civilization and agriculture. So, okay, but we know it can go haywire. You know, it doesn't require human intervention to have the climate oscillate wildly. And if we were to have another ice age, for example, it would be fairly catastrophic on our global society today. So these are the realities, you know, and we need to understand the environment better. We need to understand the modeling and the forces of nature that are causing that can cause climate change. And we need to not pretend that we can stand there and kick this bear that's sleeping and expect it not to wake up and bite us. So I think, you know, we're all on the same page when you step back and look at the issue here. We don't want to destroy the Earth's environment. We know the environment can fluctuate wildly, and we have to figure out how to weasel through this issue and come out the other end without you know, the last 15,000 years of civilization development being thrown into the winds. And so I think this is not facilitated when people just sort of get, you know, hyperventilate about something like the emails, you know, from Northumbria University, whatever. You know, I mean, okay, you can make your point, guys. We have a problem here that we really need to focus on.
And I think this issue has been politicized too much, and we are defocused from the solutions, which actually requires the attention, a balanced approach. From that perspective, the next question is, what application would you like to see in the future that does not exist today?
Oh, wow. Gee, that's an interesting question. One thing I would like to see is what I'm working on right now, which is kind of crazy idea, and that is atmospheric water harvesting. It's a field with a small number of participants, mostly in desert countries, and that sort of thing. But I think it has a lot of promise to help mitigate the impacts of droughts and that sort of thing, and allow people to live in a more copacetic and manner with the environment in areas where they don't have to, for example, tap into surface water or deplete underground aquifers and that sort of thing. So one thing I hope in the future is that that we'll have reduced the cost of atmospheric water harvesting by the same factor we've reduced the cost of solar cells and allow us to live without pipes going to reservoirs and things.
Right. Actually, you know that nearly 70% of the earth is water, and yet, like many, do not have access to potable water. And some of our colleagues, like, you know, in MIT, as well as in Hong Kong, was in Kaohsiung in the past, Peng Wang, you know, that they work on this area. Yeah. Atmospheric, like, you know, the water, or like, you know, the hydro generation. Okay, so this leads us to,
yeah, go ahead. I would like to say that it's very reminiscent of energy, in that there's lots of energy around. It's just not correct. Usable. Right. You can only use energy when there's a temperature difference or kinetic energy. But there's plenty of energy. It's just not, and it's
right.
Water. You know, there's a lot of water around, but you know, you can't drink it. And so, how do you extract it? So it has very much the same physical aspects of energy of making energy flow in a usable manner, making water flow in a usable manner. Very, very analogous to each other.
Of course. And water itself is H2O. So there is lots of hydrogen from that perspective also.
Right.
Okay. So this is the last question from the scripted ones. What is your one piece of advice for the younger generation?
Ah, okay. Well, I think my advice, of course, is for engineers. That's, I assume, who might be listening to this. I think there's a couple of things you have to keep in mind. One is you should be having fun. If you're not having fun doing engineering, whether it's as a student or in industry, there's something wrong. I mean, you should rethink what you're doing, because it should be fun, just plain fun, challenging and fun. And and the second is that if you should be continuously learning things. And so whenever I advise people that, you know, about their career paths and that sort of thing, I say, if you're learning a lot in your current situation and you're having fun, it can't be all bad. That, you know, that. If, however, you're not learning anything, or you're not having fun, something's wrong, and you should start thinking about making a change.
Right, it's why we do what we do.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Definitely, it's actually not for the engineers, it's for everyone, because, you know, everyone is one way or other an engineer. An artist is engineer, a player is an engineer. So, you know, whatever the way they are.
Right.
So thanks so much, Dick, for your time. Before we wrap up, I have one question, which is unscripted. Was there anything that we didn't ask you, but you wanted to share with us?
Oh, no, I thought your questions were great. Let's see, to share with people. I think one of the things that that students and new entries into the workforce need to think about is the importance of human interaction and dealing with people, because engineers oftentimes you know, they've spent their youth building things by themselves and reading and that sort of thing. And one of the things that surprised me when I started SunPower was that the human interaction aspects were more difficult than the technology aspects. You know, I just wasn't as prepared to deal with them, perhaps. Don't slight the importance of sort of working hard on what you might call emotional IQ, or ways to facilitate people working together and getting along together. And I think that's a lifelong skill that one should nurture and improve upon as you go along. And, you know, I could sit here and bore you with hundreds of examples of people I knew that didn't do that. And it didn't always end well. It usually didn't end well. So that's my parting advice.
Not right, right.
But human interactions and that sort of thing.
Correct. Like, you know, when you have the idea, put together the best team you can possibly have, and then inspire them.
Right, right. And when you're working in an industrial environment, you have to rely on other people to get things done for you. And
right.
You know, if you don't know how to get people in the fab, for example, to think that your engineering lots are important, and work with them as you know, real people that are important members of the team, you'll find your engineering lots don't progress too well.
Thank you for attending this IEEE EDS-sponsored podcast. To listen to other EDS podcasts, as well as benefits and resources EDS offers, please go to the website eds.ieee.org. Thank you for listening.